for today's activities. We have a pretty packed agenda for this morning, so we're going to get started right away. And you know that the topic is going to be presentations from the different RERCs, and we are very pleased to have as our moderator Tom Korfman, who is the director of the RERCs for NIDR. So please welcome Tom Korfman.
Good morning, everyone. Hello and welcome. My name is Tom Korfman, and I'm with the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, otherwise known as NIDR. And NIDR is the agency that funds the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Centers, otherwise known as the RERCs. I wanted to give you that background because I know some of you are new to RESNA and new to NIDR. I hope that you will all take some time to come to the exhibit hall and actually learn more about each individual RERC and talk to the directors and talk to them a little bit more about what they're doing, their work. Today we have four directors of RERCs, and the first that we're going to hear from is Greg Vanderheiden from the RERC on Universal Interface and Information Technology Access. Please welcome Greg.
Thank you. How many of you have ever seen the abbreviated Shakespeare Company? Okay, yes. Well, this is where somebody who gets up in an hour, they do all of the works of Shakespeare all at once. So that's what we're going to be trying to do today. We each have 10 minutes to try to cover our program. So we're going to try to click through pretty quickly. The Trace Center's RERC that we're reporting on today has to do with information technology, and our mission basically is to either prevent barriers, I should say both to prevent barriers, and to capitalize on opportunities presented by current and emerging technologies in the area of information technology. And we want to try to create a world that's accessible as possible for as many people as possible. So we're working cross-disability. And we're trying to build access in so that individuals with whatever level of ability they have or still have as we age are able to access and use the world as we encounter it. And I'm going to touch on a number of the topics quickly, and the first one has to do with access features in the operating systems. Now, Trace has developed the access features that are found in standard computer operating systems, in the Windows, the Mac, the OS. And if you look at the various operating systems, you'll actually find the same terms, sticky keys, mouse keys, in them. If we look at Vista, you'll find the mouse keys again is present, brought forward and updated. The visual notification and captions, formerly called Sound Sentry, and show sounds, and then also the sticky keys, filter keys, bounce keys, repeat keys, slow keys, and toggle keys. And we don't go into all of these, but for example, one of those allows you to be able to use the keyboard one-handed. Another one allows you to be able to use the keyboard if you have tremor without getting double keystrokes. Another one allows people with, say, severe cerebral palsy, for example, to use a keyboard. Another one for individuals who are blind, etc. Together, they provide a set of extensions now that has gone across most all of the major operating systems platforms. So you'll find them even in Linux graphic user interfaces, and they've made their way into standards around the world, so they now appear pretty much ubiquitously. Oops, got to get my frontwards and my backwards on this thing, right? In the web access area, we've been working on the web access guidelines, and so we've co-chaired the web accessibility web content guidelines and have been co-editors both on WCAG 1, which is the current international standard, and the second one, which is WCAG 2.0. The next area that we focus on is on access to the interfaces, and we have something that we call easy access. And in the easy access area, we've been working on trying to get this so that it's built into the systems that you find, so that automated teller machines can be used by people across disabilities. Door entry systems, electronic voting, all systems that we are trying to have prototypes and have been adopted in terms of features. We also have the most recent implementations have been in the World War II Memorial, the Korean Memorial in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Postal Service has automated postal systems, and in Phoenix Sky Harbor, if you actually go to the airport, you will find that throughout the airport, there are these keypads that you can watch for. On the right, you'll see them, so that individuals who used to hear, could you go to the white courtesy phone? And you'd go over to the white courtesy phone, and if you were deaf, it didn't really help you. They now have a messaging system out there where if you are deaf or if you are blind, low vision, etc., the paging not only appears auditorily, but you will also see visual pages. So whenever they page, look on the displays and you'll see that the page also goes by. And if you leave a message, people's names will stay up on that board until the people go over to one of the stations, and then they can use the system there, even if they are blind, to log in, access their messages, leave messages, etc. The keypads now are available, from made by Storm, and you can get them actually from Newark Catalog now as standard components, and then you can incorporate the easy access features in. The next area is digital talking books, and here we're working with the National Library Service to develop a new digital talking book. So we've had the other digital talking book, which has been on the for a long time using tapes. And the Library Service is now switching over to little cartridges, solid state. And so one of the things they had asked was the ability to be able to access this and be able to move into this the new area, but to not just have individuals with low vision blindness, but also people with physical disabilities, and then a special emphasis on cognitive language and learning, but disabilities and their ability to use the new systems. And so these now will be going out over the next years to replace all of the current. And it was kind of fun working on this project when we found that the individuals using this go up past 100 years of age. And we said, wow, you got a couple users up there? And they said, we have 1,400 users up there. And it just blew me away, the incredible service that's available. By the way, all of us, if we are so fortunate to live that long, will probably also be making use of these systems. Another important area that we've been looking at is universal remote consoles. And this is the ability to have something which would allow you to control any product from any other product. So you could, for example, have a your PDA or your cell phone and be able to control the different products in your house. Well, this is a mainstream because we're trying to get it really so to be incorporated into all the mainstream products. But a main target of it is to allow it so that individuals can also use their assistive technologies to be able to access and use the various things in the environment. With this, for example, you'd be able to, for the first time, individuals who are blind would be able to actually set the thermostat or to use the stoves and other appliances in their apartments. Things that individuals who are blind now are unable to use because we are very rapidly putting displays into absolutely everything, taking these offline, and they can't swap out the air conditioning system to put in one that doesn't have a display. They can't tear out the stove or the oven to put in one that doesn't have a display. The microwave, yeah, they can try and go, like, try and find one that doesn't have a display, but good luck. The ability to be able to control products from other products, in this case in the bottom right, even somebody just using Sip and Puff would be able to control all of the appliances and things in their homes. All right? The next one is direct brain interface, and this is, again, for individuals who have a locked-in syndrome, where they are unable to move anything, even their eyes in some cases, the ability to just tap in. And so work's been done with looks both putting the electrodes inside the skull, and this is typically now being just experimented with. NIH is permitting this in some parts of the country, but also just looking at what it would be, what can be done with a skull cap. I don't know if anybody here, how many people here know the Dasher program? So we were able to demonstrate someone just putting a skull cap on with practice, able to just spell whole sentences out using the Dasher program. Just thinking, you know, up, down, and steering, if you will, through the letters of the program. So this kind of capability, if those of you who have worked with locked-in syndrome patients, as I have in the past, know to have somebody who is absolutely fully there, just like you and I, just imagine that all of a sudden you just fell down and you couldn't even look left or right. You could move your eyes up and down a little bit, and that's all you have. But you're fully cognitively there, trapped inside, and the ability to begin to have a mechanism and a way of addressing these users. There's a lot of activity. We've had a number of presentations at this conference in this area. So this is an interesting area. One of the things in the future we may be able to do, actually, and we're doing an emerging technology presentation tomorrow morning at 10:30 that we talk a little bit about this. But someday you may actually be able to do things like this without actually doing anything invasive. You would just take and inject into your bloodstream, and they would flow up and then spark in the places, monitor and transmit the information out. So I mean, where we are heading with the new technologies is just enough to stop you in your tracks. A very big part also, though, is training and the ability to actually get the information out. And so getting engineering students and industry design teams to really understand. We have 30 different experience stations where individuals are able to experience and that we'll actually give them something, a mainstream product, that they are completely unable to use. And then we will, a few minutes later, give them another mainstream product that looks almost exactly like it that they have no trouble using. And after they get through about 30 of these, they start getting to the point. And the number of people from industry we've had who just said, you know, I came in thinking, yeah, sure, you know, but it's not practical for us to run our products. But when they see their products and their competitors' products that work just fine as compared to products that look just like it, they begin to see that what's being asked for isn't profound in terms of a design change. It's just profound in terms of what it requires of the user to operate it. And almost always they say, you know, actually this would be a lot easier for me when I'm, for example, one hand. I'm carrying it or I'm at the airport or I'm this or I'm that. So it's really powerful. We do it for all of the engineering students that come into the college that are taking an intro engineering course. And so we have like 100 and some students coming through it. Design teams from companies, also working with standards groups, regulatory, and even consumer advocates, et cetera, so they can better understand what is possible and what's not, so they can interact better with industry to get things forward. We also have a trace usability screening kit that has been developed and is used for helping to demonstrate these kinds of capabilities. And then finally, as I said yesterday, we have the emerging technology overview, I've said before, which will be happening tomorrow. In that we'll be talking about virtual assistive technologies, and that is basically the ability for individuals to be able to invoke assistive technologies out of the ether so that an individual with a disability could sit down at any computer and be able to call up the accessibility features they want to out of the network rather than having to do it themselves or have it or buy it or afford it or have it with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Time is short, so we're asking that if you have any questions for any of our speakers today, please head on down to the exhibit hall to RERC row and ask them. Next up is Frank DeRider from the RERC on Communication Enhancement. Please welcome Greg. Sorry.
Thank you, Tom. Also, on behalf of all the RERC directors, I do want to thank Glenn, Ray, Tom, and the Resnet leadership for hosting this. This is much appreciated. With the RERC on communication enhancement, and we have set ourselves up as a partnership. So there's seven primary institutions throughout the United States that are a part of our work. We've actively included consumers, users of augmentative communication systems and their families in both the research, the development, as well as the training and dissemination. I want to go through just a couple of projects with you that we have would like to highlight. The first is BlackBerry Serial Keys. It's Kevin Caves. The BlackBerry application was developed to allow a person with using an AEC device to send and receive emails wirelessly through a current model of a BlackBerry device. This obviously has been an issue in the AEC field for those who are non-speaking. It's a collaborative project with a number of folks, including the RIM, the wireless RERC, and Georgia Tech, so collaboration with other individuals and other sites. It's a Java application. It's been tested on several BlackBerry devices, along with tested on several COM devices. Connects through Bluetooth, implements a GIDI protocol. Real brief video, if it'll load. And maybe, there it goes. I guess you got to hit play. Amazing. So setting it up here. And then you'll see the OGCOM device coming to the screen here in just a second. Actually, it's being controlled by the OGCOM here. Now the AAC user is actually using the thumb, the trackball on the BlackBerry. I'm controlling it now from the AAC device. Stop and move on. Originally, we were told we had 15 minutes, and then it got down to 12 minutes, and then down to 10 minutes. So, transfer, we've tested, like I said, on several OGCOM devices. We've also identified, or Kevin's identified, a serial to Bluetooth adapter for legacy devices, some of the older devices that allow Bluetooth connectivity, and this information is available on our website. Puddingstone Place, done by Howard Chain and his group out of Boston Children's Hospital, started off as a research project. Looking at contextual scenes and intelligent agents. And one of the findings of that research was that electronic media was the highest type of interaction with individuals in the autism spectrum. The kids were most interested in animated characters. There's clearly consistency across the different media. And this media really was quite something in terms of instructional medium. So the goal was to develop a communication system using contextual scenes in an interactive virtual learning environment. And out of that came the development of Puddingstone Place. It's turned out that it's quite a powerful learning tool, not only in communication, but also in vocabulary and in language. And it's a strong motivator in therapy. And it's currently being distributed by Boston Children's Hospital. And they just...
Do you want to hear a joke?
Because of a chromosome problem, Max can't speak on his own. But he's a smart little boy, and he uses a synthesizer to tell jokes.
What do you call a cat that drinks lemonade? A sourpuss.
His vocabulary and communication skills are getting better all the time because of this.
Hi, my name is Jim. I'm going to show you around the house.
Welcome to the virtual world of Puddingstone Place.
Click on the door, and let's go.
Max explores the house.
This is the kitchen.
Clicking on items to learn their names.
Hose.
Playing.
Let's play the sticky bubblegum game.
And even making music.
Guitar. Tambourine. Drum.
It's designed for kids with communication problems like autism and other developmental disorders. Experts at the hospital say those children respond best to visual information.
There are a number of objects that can come alive. If you click on the tea kettle, it whistles. If you click on the microwave oven, it makes some popcorn.
Dr. Howard Shane developed the interactive world.
It's an environment that really invites them in. And for some children who might be resistant to some face-to-face or some more traditional learning...
The If you're interested, Howard Chain through Boston Children's Hospital can provide more information. The other parts of this particular project is now moving to a second phase, Puddingstone Place 2, and really looking at providing on-demand material for families who are not able to get services necessarily because of third-party reimbursement. So they have access to the materials and can teach some of these concepts. Looking at expanding the community, and then also looking at where Puddingstone Place should reside, whether it should be a PC resident program or become web-based. And one of the programs, or one of the things we've been looking at, is Second Life. And for those of you that are not familiar with Second Life, it's a 3D virtual world built and owned by residents. It has over 7 million people around the globe. And these are just some images that I pulled down off of Second Life to give you an idea of how that might fit in with the earlier work that we're doing. Another project, Web Crawler. This is done by the folks at Buffalo and also in collaboration with Dynavox. What is Web Crawler? It uses the AEC device to search the web for additional topic-specific vocabulary. The really is a system to prime the word prediction, if you will, of the ICOM system. Research findings have shown that topic-specific communication is improved by web crawling on both core and fringe vocabulary. What the operator sees is on the left. What's really happening in the background is that it's going out into the web and searching and bringing in vocabulary on a particular topic. This video is an example. So you might have a student who's in a history or social studies class, and they're talking about Abraham Lincoln for the next few days. And so would go on the ICOM system, put in Abraham Lincoln. And this is showing the example if you wanted to say Abraham Lincoln signed the Proclamation of Emancipation, just how long that process takes. But before class, you could go in and put in Abraham Lincoln, hit crawl, it would search the web, takes a couple of minutes. And then it'll come back with a host of vocabulary related to that particular topic. So now when you put in Abraham, and you want to say Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation, you can see that the word prediction, because those now reside in the memory. Okay, it just enhances rate of communication then, which is always an ongoing desire. Virtual scenes display for adults and aphasia with traumatic brain injury, and I hope you get the idea that we are crossing the age spectrum, the age span. Emergence of dynamic display systems in the last few years in the field of augmentative communication. And one of the research efforts out of the folks in Nebraska has been to look at visual contextual pictures and how might you use visual contextual scenes or pictures with traumatic brain injury and persons with aphasia. So the purpose of the project was to design an interface that would facilitate representation and allow you to navigate the display. So a visual scene display then really is just an interface. It's organized through a lot of contextual pictures of relevance to the communicator and the circle of communicators in that person's environment. It's people, actions, objects. It captures on just-in-time programming so that you can drag and drop visual images. You can navigate on the fly, on-screen text entry, and then have multiple templates based on where that person is cognitively. So here, navigation strategies, you see the diversity of themes, of colors, of using colors and contrast to tap and learning. Here you see on-screen editing. You can just literally drag and drop and configure the display for the particular individual, different template options.
I didn't recognize it. I'd like to cook a lot.
I I think the message in this video is that's so powerful is that typically with people with aphasia, communication goes one way, and this what we're seeing is communication now being interactive and going two ways. This is transferred out. It's now commercially available, and a lot of press recently, and also on TV media. Finally, I want to talk real briefly about dissemination. We were fortunate, John Hockenberry, several years ago on Wired magazine, highlighted one of our partners, Michael Williams, and I think the power of dissemination was really enhanced. Our website, aacrerc.org, we do have a webcast series, a number of webcasts that are available for viewing, both for students, families, what have you. All the information on AAC funding related to Medicare and other funding streams is on our website. Writers Brigade, real quick project that is established in 2004. It's managed by AAC users. Members of the Writers Brigade are paid. We pay them to write articles and help in dissemination. Over 90 publications to date. 14 individuals have gone through the program. Like I said, we pay them. They develop a portfolio, and several of these now have actually become employed. Some of the different publication venues where their work in terms of dissemination has appeared. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank. Next up, please welcome Stephen Gard from the RERC on prosthetics and orthotics.
Okay, here we go. I too would like to thank the resident leadership for the opportunity for us to share information about the NIDER RERC program. And our center is concerned with prosthetics and orthotics, and there is a significant need in this country. There's a number of, there's literally millions of prosthesis and orthosis users. And for 2007, we estimate there's about 1.5 million people with some sort of a major limb amputation, with roughly 200,000 additional amputations being performed annually. And there's about 5 million orthosis users in the country at this point. Now, additionally, over the past several years, there's been considerable attention paid to the soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've been receiving a lot of coverage about the amputations that are being sustained. As of May 1st, there were roughly 580 soldiers who have returned with some sort of a major limb amputation, but of those 580, 31 have returned to active duty. And this population actually creates new challenges because they are much more demanding of their prosthesis than the typical user here in the United States. There's considerable need for prosthetics and orthotics research because currently the practice in prosthetics and orthotics is very much an art form, and that's not a criticism, that's merely an observation. We need to quantify what prosthetists and orthotists do, and in this age of evidence-based medicine, prosthetists and orthotists need to be able to justify their prescriptions by pointing to scientific data. Additionally, we need foundational knowledge. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence in the field of prosthetics and orthotics at the moment, and but there's not a lot that we can make our decisions on or build upon in order to justify reimbursement. The priority for our RERC is to increase understanding of scientific and engineering principles pertaining to human locomotion, reaching, grasping, and manipulation, and incorporate those principles into the design and fitting of prosthetic and orthotic devices. And in response to this priority, we propose 10 research projects looking at lower limb prosthetics, lower limb orthotics, spinal orthotics, upper limb prosthetics, and even doing some studies of able-bodied walking. And additionally, we have 6 development projects. We have a number of staff and faculty in our RERC devoted to this effort. We also have a quarterly newsletter called Capabilities that we publish. And if you're interested in picking up copies of Capabilities, we have a number of these at our booth in the exhibit hall. And additionally, you can subscribe to our newsletter if you'd like. These are also downloadable from our website. A significant portion of the research effort in our RERC is conducted by graduate students. I think at the moment we have 13 graduate students in our laboratory. These are master's and PhD students who come to us through the Department of Biomedical Engineering at Northwestern University and who conduct research in our laboratory to satisfy their degree requirements. The largest area of research in our laboratory, in our RERC, pertains to ambulation and aided ambulation. Incidentally, this is Mr. Brian Rui. He's one of the graduate students in our laboratory. He's walking in our motion analysis lab, as you can see here. He has bilateral above-knee amputations, and he's been a research subject in a lot of our studies. We're interested in learning more about the functional requirements of walking. So we do conduct studies of able-bodied gait to try to better understand why we move the way that we do. And then once we understand this function, we have a means by which we can evaluate different prosthetic and orthotic gaits. And we also have criteria that we can use for designing better prosthetic and orthotic components. There's just a few projects here that I want to touch on and share information with you. The first one pertains to the evaluation and design a function of stance control orthotic knee joints. Here's a gentleman walking with a locked knee ankle foot orthosis. And notice whenever he walks, you can see the gait doesn't look very aesthetic. It doesn't look like that of an able-bodied person. And in fact, you can see it is asymmetric, that he's having to compensate because his knee doesn't flex during the swing phase. But it doesn't flex during the swing phase. It's required to be locked because he needs that stability in stance phase. Well, there are some new components on the market known as stance control orthotic knee joints that lock in the stance phase and unlock during swing phase. Well, you can see visually there is improvement in the gait here. So here's some of the anecdotal evidence why an orthotist may choose to fit somebody with a patient or with this device, for example. But in our laboratory, we're interested in quantifying this effect, documenting it, and publishing that data to indicate the efficacy of devices like this. This particular project involved the efforts of one of our graduate students, Ms. Kiki Zizimopoulos, who did this work for her master's degree. And in fact, Kiki's here at the meeting. She is working the exhibit booth, and you can come by and learn more about this project. Just a quick summary of some of the results that she found is when subjects walked with the auto mode, that is, with this knee joint locked in stance phase, unlocked in swing phase, their gait did resemble that more of an able-bodied individual. So the gait was more aesthetically pleasing. We believe it was a more functional gait. The compensatory mechanisms that tend to be utilized in a locked knee ankle foot orthosis were minimized or reduced in the auto mode. And finally, kind of a surprising finding here was we also looked at energy expenditure of subjects walking with these devices, the stance control orthotic knee joint in a lock mode, unlock mode, and the auto mode. And we found that there wasn't a significant difference between the auto mode and the lock mode with this knee ankle foot orthosis. But it could be that the added stability kind of outweighs the effects of energy expenditure by users. Another project I want to talk about concerns our shape and roll prosthetic foot, and particularly the gathering of data in order to develop a pediatric prosthetic foot. We've been interested in rollover shapes in our laboratory, and rollover shapes is the effective shape or geometry that the anatomical foot and ankle acquires during the stance phase of walking. You can see it acquires this nice rocker shape, and this is something we can measure in the laboratory. We've done numerous studies on this, and we found that for the most part, able-bodied ambulators tend to walk with a constant or invariant rollover shape for all situations. So with this idea of rollover shapes, we were involved in a collaborative project with the RERC on Improved Technology Access for Landmine Survivors to develop a prosthetic foot based upon this rollover shape principle. And particularly, we were interested in developing a very functional foot, simple in design, easy to manufacture for use in developing countries. Now, if you look closely here, you can see that this foot has cuts in the forefoot region. And the cuts are spaced very specifically so that when a person loads this forefoot, that the keel will bend and provide an appropriate rollover shape. But we at this point, we don't know whether it's appropriate to take this adult-sized foot, this design, and simply scale it down for use in children. So what we're currently doing at the moment is gathering information from a number of pediatric clinical gait laboratories around the country and analyzing that data so that we can, as a next step, design and develop this pediatric prosthetic foot. The last project I want to discuss is one of our development projects, development of an equilibrium point prosthetic ankle joint. And the idea here is we wanted to develop a passive component that would adapt to changing terrain. One of the problems with a lot of prostheses at the moment is they're great. Technology has advanced to the point to where they're great for walking on flat level surfaces. But the problem is in everyday life, people tend to encounter more than just flat surfaces. So we encounter uneven terrain, we walk up and down slopes. We need prosthetic components that can adapt accordingly. And not only adapt in terms of the positioning of the component, but also adapt their stiffness accordingly and appropriately. So this is the prototype that we developed. This was actually one of the a project by Ryan Williams, one of our master's students, who's going to be defending here a week from Tuesday. He entered this prototype in the student design competition, and from what I understand, he did receive an award for this. And he's going to be speaking this afternoon about this design further. And if you'd like to see this design, you can come by the exhibit booth, and we have it on display there. Here's some preliminary data. I don't want to take anything away from Ryan's presentation for this afternoon, but I did want to show you quickly with one unilateral for one person with unilateral transtibial amputation in our laboratory walking with his usual prostheses up and down slopes, we didn't see any accommodation in rollover shape. There was no adjustment to these surfaces. But when he walked with this prototype that Ryan developed, suddenly we started seeing adaptation of this unit similar to that that able-bodied individuals use, which is very promising. The next area I wanted to talk about concerns a State of the Science meeting that we held last year. And for the NIDER RERCs, NIDER requires that the RERCs hold a State of the Science meeting in the third year of their funding. So we conducted this State of the Science meeting, and the theme of this meeting was research in prosthetics and orthotics. Are we addressing clinically relevant problems? There's a lot of research going on, particularly in the field of prosthetics and at the moment, that involves a lot of high technology. But it seems that a lot of the more fundamental basic issues are not being addressed. So we created a forum for prosthetists and orthotists to come in and share with us ideas that they have for where they think the research needs to go based upon their experience and based upon user feedback. And we did this through a combination of an online survey and forum through this meeting. And also we presented these results, preliminary results, at the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists Conference and opened the floor for comment at the end of that presentation. The idea is that this information will be disseminated to researchers, clinicians, and to various funding agencies with the hope of influencing prosthetics and orthotics research in the future. If you'd like to get a copy of this report, I think we have a couple of copies still at our exhibit booth, but additionally you can download it at our website. And probably the best way to get to our website or to this report is to go to Google, type in SOS_report.pdf, or you can go directly to our webpage just by typing NUPRL-RERP. The last area I want to talk about just very quickly here concerns the involvement of students with disabilities. And we started bringing students with disabilities into our program about 10 years ago through the Dole Scholar Program, which became the NIDER Young Scholar Program. And in our current RERC, we actually set aside funds to continue doing this under our current RERC, doing it annually now. And this is just a few of the students who we've had involved in some of our research. One of those was Brian Rui, whose picture I showed you earlier. Brian originally came into our laboratory in 1996 as an undergraduate student from Wright State University, but then he decided to apply to graduate school at Northwestern. He came to our laboratory, got his master's degree. He's currently working on his PhD, looking at adaptable alignment on inclines and declines. Another young woman who we had involved in our RERC was Ms. Kelly Lim, who just graduated from UCLA Medical School about a week and a half ago. And Kelly's been featured a lot in the press lately. Some of you may have seen the stories in the Los Angeles Times. On ABC World News, she was selected as Person of the Week about 2 weeks ago, and she was featured on NBC National News in the Making a Difference segment. Now, I had a video clip I was going to show here, but I think I'm out of time. If you're interested in seeing this video clip, please come by the exhibit booth and I'll share it with you. It's really interesting. Then I'd like to acknowledge the funding from NIDER for this RERC, and I'd like to end with a picture of the Chicago cow with prosthetic legs, entitled She's Got Legs. The artist is Terry Karpowitz. He himself uses a transfemoral prosthesis, and he is a subject in many of our studies. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Steve. Our last speaker of this morning is Karen Milchus, and she's from the RERC on workplace accommodations. So please welcome Karen.
Hi, today I'm going to be talking about the RERC on workplace accommodations, where I'm co-director with John Sanford. Now, our RERC is a little bit different in that we don't focus on a particular area of technology or a particular type of disability. We're focusing on an environment, the workplace. And workplace accommodations are strategies, environmental modifications, or technology that can be used to help a person with a disability perform work tasks. And that can include things like an information system interface to help a librarian do her work. It could be a prosthesis grip for a farmer. It could be a communication device that a person uses for office work. Well, who needs these? Well, I would say that I have the biggest need out of these four, because we're covering anyone who's employed or wants to be. There are over 4 million people with disabilities who are currently employed. We're also talking about potential employees. There are approximately 70% of people with disabilities under the age of 65 are unemployed. And we're also talking possibly about aging workers, people who are beginning to experience some age-related disabilities. And by 2012, 19% of employees will be 55 or older. We also need to look at the type of impact that workplace accommodations have. We conducted a national survey and found that 75% of people could not perform all of their job duties without workplace accommodations. And 15% reported that they had been fired or laid off in the past because they had been unable to get the accommodations that they needed. Well, the mission of our RERC is to identify, develop, and promote new assistive and universally designed technologies that maximize independence and participation of people with disabilities in the workplace. And this is a little bit of a different focus from what we normally think of as workplace accommodations, where we're usually focused on service delivery. Because we're an RERC, we're focused on research and development, not service delivery. We're looking at a focus on broad-based needs rather than the needs of one individual. And we're looking at a universal approach to some of our designs, not one-of-a-kind types of designs. And this has offered us both some great opportunities, but also some challenges. For example, when we started out in 2002, we were a brand new center. NIDER hadn't funded research in this area for a few years, and we found, well, there's a lack of research evidence on workplace accommodations, apparently similar to with prosthetics. There isn't that much information out there about what types of things are working and for whom. And in fact, when we did a literature review, out of 30 articles that we looked at, 19 of them were single-subject case studies. There isn't as much information out there looking at trends. So for our research projects, most of our research projects fall into kind of two categories, looking at developing the body of knowledge about workplace accommodations and user needs. Again, what types of accommodations work for whom and in what settings. Information that we can then base clinical decisions on. and also looking at the impact of policies and practices on how people get accommodations. And I don't have time to talk about some of our findings here. I'd like to point you instead to our webpage, and also we have a list of some of our recent publications at our exhibit booth. Instead, I'd like to focus on some of our development projects. First of all, we have a development doesn't have to always involve technology devices. One of our development projects actually is a assessment tool, looking more at a procedure. And the idea behind this project is we want to look at how a person might be able to conduct a workplace assessment remotely, particularly if you have a person who's working in an area that's a little bit far from the office and you don't want to spend all that travel time. So we're looking at ways in which we can use teleconferencing equipment to conduct the assessment remotely. Well, you can imagine if you're trying to do that, you need a very strict protocol, you know, a procedure to follow to make sure that you're collecting all the information that you need and looking at how that information is being collected. So we're working on that. We first looked at what types of assessments were currently being used, and from that we developed a framework upon which we can sort of do that comparison. Unfortunately, we found that none of the existing protocols quite met our requirements, so we are actually in the final stages of putting together something specifically for remote use. Our other projects are looking at more universally designed technologies, things including a supine computer workstation, a screen reading customization tool, some information about access to CNC equipment that was presented by Scott Haynes yesterday, and a universal retail check stand, and I want to talk about a couple of those projects today. Well, first of all, another challenge that we ran into with our more universal design focus is that most of the accommodation work that's been done in the past has focused on the needs of an individual. And some of you might recognize a few of these pictures. Three of those are from past job accommodation show and tells here at Resna. And they're all for workstations that people can use in a reclined position. So obviously there's a recurring need here. One of those designs was actually our own. So one of our projects that we're looking at is a supine computer workstation, and we are always, I think all of our employees always want to try this out because they get to lay down on the job. But basically it's a computer workstation that allows you to recline, actually fully recline, and it places less stress on the back and minimizes low back pain. Of course, because we're not designing for a specific individual, we had to take a bit of a step back and look at what types of measurements, what types of positioning of this equipment is needed so that it can fit a wide range of users. We also took a look at what types of impact these reclined positions have on job performance, because it's going to be very difficult for us to try to convince an employer to purchase these things if the person is no longer being productive. And fortunately, we found that might be a little bit of a decrease in typing speed, but nothing too significant. So, another project that we have is AudioMorph, and it's a software tool that automates the process of customizing screen reading interfaces. If you are using JAWS, there are some shortcuts built in for working with the common applications. But if you're using one of these proprietary systems, normally you would have to have a programmer come out and customize that for the individual. What we're trying to do is setting up a tool that you can have a coworker go through and set up the macros for that person. We've completed alpha testing for this product, and we're now looking at ways that we can get this out to the public. And the last project I wanted to talk about today was a universal retail check stand. There's been a lot of work looking at workstations for office employees, but not as much looking at other types of occupations. So one of the things that we're doing is looking at developing a retail check stand so that not only a person with a disability can be a customer at a grocery store, they might also be the cashier. Again, because we're talking about trying to design something that fits a wide range of users, we took a step back, did a lot of studies with people moving groceries back and forth across a scanner, looking at reach ranges, forces that were needed, tall, short, wheelchair users, people who are pregnant. And you see in this picture over here some of the measurements that we were making for that. Now, this particular application was a little bit different in that there isn't a set manufacturer out there for retail check stands. So instead of coming up with a final product that we're marketing, we actually came up with design guidelines, because many of these Publix and you know other stores actually just contract out to other cabinet makers and things like that to develop their check stands. And this way, the other designers who are building this will have something to build their specs on. And we have some copies of this at our exhibit hall as well. So are we going with all this? Well, first of all, we need to do a lot more work in terms of collecting more and better evidence upon which to base practice. This includes things like needs over time. How does this differ for aging workers? And what is the impact of some of these accommodations? What's some of the cost benefit? And that's some of the work that we hope to move into in the future. We need to explore ways to apply new technologies to workplace accommodations. As I mentioned, this crosses a wide range of technologies, and there may be people in this room who are doing some work who might think of ideas that some of the stuff that they're working on could be applied to workplace settings. We also need to begin to address a little bit more work with employees with some of the unmet needs. We found from our research that there are a lot of accommodation options for people with motor impairments, people with sensory difficulties, but there really isn't as much for people with cognitive disabilities, and it isn't as well understood. So that's an area where there's a lot more need. And communication disabilities, people with communication disabilities remained among the highest unemployment rates. And then finally, I just wanted to say that a lot of this is going to involve applying the expertise of researchers from a variety of areas. And I would like to invite all of you to check out some of the sessions being held here by the Job Accommodation SIG to find out other ways that you can merge some of your research with things that are going on with workplace accommodations. So, thank you. Please check out our website and visit us in the exhibit hall.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. I just want to thank everyone for attending. I'd like to thank Resna for the opportunity, for giving us the opportunity to have this session. Thank the speakers, and also just wrap up by saying that NIDR is very proud of the RERC program and the many fine accomplishments of the RERCs. So thank you for all attending.
But don't go away. First, I want to thank the presenters for the valiant efforts to stay within the very strict time and giving you really important information about what's going on, often outside your field of interest and, hopefully outside your field of work, but within your field of interest. So on behalf of Resna, I would like to give you a little token of our appreciation. And now we'll have Dave Jaffe present another set of awards, and then I'll have some announcements to follow it up.
Great. Good morning, everybody. Will the following people please make their way to the stage? Mark Schmaler, Juliana Arva, Brenda Crane, Barbara Crane, Kimberly Davis, Jerry Dickerson, Ken Cazol, Brenda Spasato, and Kelly Wah. Climb up. Mark, you're first.
Oh, good. I'll be the only one up there.
Okay. This morning's awards are certificates of appreciation, which recognize a Resna member or non-member for a special one-time activity benefiting Resna. What happened? Okay. Recognizing a Resna member or non-member for a special one-time activity benefiting Resna or the fields of rehab or assistive technology. These awards today are awarded to the leader, Mark, and the 10 members of the Ad Hoc Seating and Mobility Specialty Credential Committee. This group developed a proposed process for identifying specialists in seating and mobility as a second tier to the ATP certification. This is the first specialty area proposed for this advanced certification. Anita Pear, who is the nominator of this group, says that it is with the hard work of this committee that the process of certifying specialists in seating and mobility may occur. They should be acknowledged for the quality of their proposal that they developed in a very short time. So on to the awards. First, Mark Schmaler, who was the leader of the group. This is him.
Mark, congratulations. Thanks very much.
Juliana is next.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations. Thanks for
next is Brenda. Kendra.
Kendra.
Okay.
Is Kendra not here?
Kendra's not here. Sorry. Barbara's next. Okay.
Barb. Oh, yeah. We'll have to double check later.
Yeah, right.
Oh, actually, that's right. There we go. Kimberly Davis. There you go. Jerry Dickerson.
Good to see you. Same thing.
Ken Cazal.
Great to see you.
Michelle Lang is not here. We'll mail her award to her. Brenda Spazzato.
Nice to meet you,
Ben. Long time no see.
Barbara Sweet Michaels is not here. And finally, Kelly Waugh.
She's here somewhere.
She was here, but not here right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One of these is really mine. Oh, that's Kim.
Yeah.
Oh, there's me.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so this is great. We were right on time and a few announcements, and we'll be ready to go out, get something to drink, and start the workshops. A reminder that the town hall meeting, which is your opportunity to talk to, ask tough questions, and offer insights to the organization's leadership, is going to be in this room from 6 to 7. We'll have all the board members and committee chairs present and accountable to you. That's going to be followed by some a light food offering and going into the more formal award ceremony. So we urge you all to be there. You don't have to be a member to benefit from the town hall and award experience. As promised, I know on the bulletin board out in front, there is information on how to get the handouts for those who you did not receive it from Mary Ewer's great presentation yesterday with her resource list. The exhibit hall closes at 3:30 today, so don't delay in spending time to get around and visit the different exhibitors who are here. The lunch will be offered at 12:30. You know, if you're a conference goer, that you don't want to be too late for that. And also, this is the opportunity to check out the second round of poster sessions that will be held in the exhibit hall and have one-on-one connections with those paper presenters. We really rely on your input and comments and suggestions and criticisms as we plan these conferences. So I want to urge all of you, this is the last time you're going to be hearing from me, so now is my opportunity to encourage you to fill out the forms and make those comments and submit it, given into the registration desk. And I'm not going to be taking off this ribbon until Tuesday afternoon, so come up to me or other committee members with your comments as well. Second to last, unfortunately, we have an attendee who has misplaced her eyeglasses that she requires to be able to drive home. So if anyone has seen a pair of glasses with some gold inlays, please turn them in to the registration table. So look around where you go, and if you see a set of glasses that's not tied to somebody, please help her out and turn it in. And As many of you are hoping and waiting, we have the CEU number, which is 7785B. Thank you. See you in the halls.